Reardon listened, feeling numb. But under the numbness, like the first thrust of a seed breaking through, he felt an emotion he could not identify, except that it seemed familiar and very distant, like something experienced and renounced long ago. "What I actually am, Mr. Reardon, is a policeman. It is a policeman's duty to protect men from criminals, criminals being those who seize wealth by force. It is a policeman's duty to retrieve stolen property and return it to its owners. But when robbery becomes the purpose of the law, and the policeman's duty becomes not the protection but the plunder of property, then it is an outlaw who has to become a policeman. I have been selling the cargoes I retrieve to some special customers of mine in this country, who pay me in gold. Also, I have been selling my cargoes to the smugglers and the black market traders of the people states of Europe. Do you know the conditions that exist in those people states? Since production and trade, not violence, were decreed to be crimes, the best men of Europe had no choice but to become criminals. The slave drivers of those states are kept in power by the handouts from their fellow looters in countries not yet fully drained, such as this country. I do not let the handouts reach them. I sell the goods to Europe's lawbreakers at the highest prices I can get, and I make them pay me in gold. Gold is the objective value, the means of preserving one's wealth and one's future. Nobody is permitted to have gold in Europe, except the whip-wielding friends of humanity who claim that they spend it for the welfare of their victims. That is the gold which my smuggler customers obtain to pay me. How? By the same method I use to obtain the goods. And then I return the gold to those from whom the goods were stolen. To you, Mr. Reardon, and to other men like you. Reardon grasped the nature of the emotion he had forgotten. It was the emotion he had felt when, at the age of 14, he had looked at his first paycheck, when, at the age of 24, he had been made superintendent of the ore mines, when, as the owner of the mines, he had placed in his own name his first order for new equipment from the best concern of the time, 20th Century Motors. An emotion of solemn, joyous excitement. The sense of winning his place in a world he respected and earning the recognition of men he admired. For almost 2 decades, that emotion had been buried under a mount of wreckage, as the years had added layer upon gray layer of contempt, of indignation, of his struggle not to look around him, not to see those he dealt with, not to expect anything from men, and to keep as a private vision within the four walls of his office the sense of that world into which he had hoped to rise. Yet there it was again, breaking through from under the wreckage, that feeling of quickened interest, of listening to the luminous voice of reason, with which one could communicate and deal and live. But it was the voice of a pirate, speaking about acts of violence, offering him this substitute for his world of reason and justice. He could not accept it. He could not lose whatever remnant of his vision he still retained. He listened, wishing he could escape, yet knowing that he would not miss a word of it. I deposit the gold in a bank, in a gold standard bank, Mr. Reardon, to the account of men who are its rightful owners. They are the men of superlative ability who made their fortunes by personal effort in free trade, using no compulsion, no help from the government. They are the great victims who have contributed the most and suffered the worst injustice in return. Their names are written in my book of restitution. Every load of gold which I bring back is divided among them and deposited to their accounts. Who are they? You're one of them, Mr. Reardon. I cannot compute all the money that has been extorted from you in hidden taxes, in regulations, in wasted time, in lost effort, in energy spent to overcome artificial obstacles. I cannot compute the sum. But if you wish to see its magnitude, look around you. The extent of the misery now spreading through this once prosperous country is the extent of the injustice which you have suffered. If men refuse to pay the debt they owe you, this is the manner in which they will pay for it. But there is one part of the debt which is computed and on record. That is the part which I have made it my purpose to collect and return to you.
What is that?
Your income tax, Mr. Reardon.
What?
Your income tax for the last 12 years. You intend to refund that? In full and in gold, Mr. Reardon. Reardon burst out laughing. He laughed like a young boy, in simple amusement, in enjoyment of the incredible.
Good God, you're a policeman, and a collector of internal revenue, too?
Yes, said Donnishold gravely.
You're not serious about this, are you?
Do I look as if I'm joking? But this is preposterous.
Any more preposterous than Directive 10-289?
It's not real or possible. Is only evil real and possible?
But are you thinking that death and taxes are our only certainty, Mr. Reardon? Well, there's nothing I can do about the first. But if I lift the burden of the second, men might learn to see the connection between the two, and what a longer, happier life they have the power to achieve. They might learn to hold not death and taxes, but life and production as their two absolutes, and as the base of their moral code.
Reardon looked at him, not smiling. The tall, slim figure with the windbreaker stressing its trained, muscular agility was that of a highwayman. The stern marble face was that of a judge. The dry, clear voice was that of an efficient bookkeeper.
The looters are not the only ones who have kept records on you, Mr. Reardon.
So have I. I have in my files copies of all your income tax returns for the last 12 years, as well as the returns of all my other clients. I have friends in some astonishing places who obtain the copies I need. I divide the money among my clients in proportion to the sums extorted from them. Most of my accounts have now been paid to their owners. Yours is the largest one left to settle. On the day when you will be ready to claim it, the day when I'll know that no penny of it will go back to support the looters, I will turn your account over to you. Until then, he glanced down at the gold on the ground. Pick it up, Mr. Reardon. It's not stolen. It's yours.
Reardon would not move, or answer, or look down.
Much more than that lies in the bank in your name.
What bank?
Do you remember Midas Mulligan of Chicago?
Yes, of course.
All my accounts are deposited at the Mulligan Bank.
There is no Mulligan Bank in Chicago.
It is not in Chicago. Reardon let a moment pass.
Where is it?
I think that you will know it before long, Mr. Reardon, but I cannot tell you now. He added,
I must tell you, however, that I am the only one responsible for this undertaking. It is my own personal mission. No one is involved in it but me and the men of my ship's crew. Even my banker has no part in it, except for keeping the money I deposit. Many of my friends do not approve of the course I've chosen, but we all choose different ways to fight the same battle. And this is mine.
Reardon smiled contemptuously.
Aren't you one of those damn altruists who spends his time on a non-profit venture and risks his life merely to serve others?
No, Mr. Reardon. I am investing my time in my own future. When we are free and have to start rebuilding from out of the ruins, I want to see the world reborn as fast as possible. If there is then some working capital in the right hands, in the hands of our best, our most productive men, it will save years for the rest of us, and incidentally centuries for the history of the country.
Did you ask what you meant to me?
Everything I admire, everything I want to be on the day when the earth will have a place for such state of being, everything I want to deal with, even if this is the only way I can deal with you and be of use to you at present.
Why? Whispered Reardon.
Because, my only love, the only value I care to live for, is that which has never been loved by the world, has never won recognition or friends or defenders. Human ability. That is the love I am serving. And if I should lose my life, to what better purpose could I give it?
The man who had lost the capacity to feel, thought Reardon, and knew that the austerity of the marble face was the form of a disciplined capacity to feel too deeply. The even voice was continuing dispassionately.
I wanted you to know this. I wanted you to know it now, when it must seem to you that you're abandoned at the bottom of a pit among subhuman creatures who are all that's left of mankind. I wanted you to know in your most hopeless hour that the day of deliverance is much closer than you think. And there was one special reason why I had to speak to you and tell you my secret ahead of the proper time. Have you heard of what happened to Oren Boyle's steel mills on the coast of Maine?
Yes, said Reardon, and was shocked to hear that the word came as a gasp out of the sudden jolt of eagerness within him. I didn't know whether it was true.
It's true, I did it. Mr. Boyle is not going to manufacture Reardon metal on the coast of Maine. He is not going to manufacture it anywhere. Neither is any other looting louse who thinks that a directive can give him a right to your brain. Whoever attempts to produce that metal will find his furnaces blown up, his machinery blasted, his shipments wrecked, his plant set on fire. So many things will happen to any man who tries it that people will say there's a curse on it. And there will soon be no worker in the country willing to enter the plant of any new producer of Reardon metal. If men like Boyle think that force is all they need to rob their betters, let them see what happens when one of their betters chooses to resort to force. I wanted you to know, Mr. Reardon, that none of them will produce your metal, nor make a penny on it.